This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, March 11th. I'm Eric Latch, a staff writer at The New Yorker, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. On March 2nd, 2020, the day after a healthcare worker returning from Iran became the first person diagnosed with COVID-19 in New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo gave the first of what would become nearly daily briefings on the state's response to the pandemic.
There is no doubt that there will be more cases where we find people who test positive. We said early on, it wasn't a question of if, but when. This is New York. We're a gateway to the world. You see all these cases around the world, around the country. Of course, we're going to have it here.
In the months that followed, Cuomo became a kind of avatar for competent government pandemic response. In contrast to the floundering and raging of Donald Trump, Cuomo offered direct, stern, visible leadership that many people craved.
We lose 2,753 lives on 9/11. We've lost over 7,000 lives to this crisis. That is so shocking and painful and breathtaking. I don't even have the words for it.
Recently, though, Cuomo's COVID hero image has fallen apart. Multiple scandals over sexual harassment claims made against him by former aides, as well as his suppression of data concerning pandemic nursing home deaths, have led to growing calls for his resignation and threatened to topple his governorship. Nick Paumgarten, a New Yorker staff writer who wrote a profile of Cuomo that was published in October, joins me to discuss how Cuomo went from being, as one of his antagonists called him, the boyfriend of all America, to being under fire, and what the recent scandals mean for his political career. Nick, welcome.
Hi, Eric.
So I thought maybe we could start with something that you wrote in your piece from October about the image that was formed of Cuomo at the height of the pandemic, that the way that he was elevated, both in New York and sort of nationally, as a kind of hero, and then how that image sort of clashed with both Cuomo's history, his sort of long career in politics, and also just in the way it had started to rub off in the sense of sort of the way that his response to the pandemic and his leadership in the pandemic started to look, even before these scandals hit. I mean, you know, maybe it would be helpful to hear sort of, you know, what that dynamic felt like in the fall, you know, and then maybe we could talk about how it feels now.
Well, when I first started following Cuomo as a possible subject for a story, it was, you know, I think it was April. And that was basically the peak of his national and local popularity as the soothing and commanding voice of COVID response. You know, and this was at a time when there was something like zero response at the federal level. And here was Cuomo every day on TV speaking in paragraphs. He has this sort of seductive, commanding voice. He emphasized what seemed like very pragmatic responses to this overwhelming problem. And he had the authority of someone who was in the most battle-torn, COVID-torn state at the time, or one of them anyway. That quickly took hold as a narrative of the pandemic and was quickly sort of churned into the popular culture. As you know, the term Cuomosexual was coined, and the idea that people were in love with Andy. It became part of a popular cultural response to this whole thing. In the meantime, you know, the pandemic raged on, and his, you know, longtime enemies grumbled, and different press outlets looked into different elements of his response, the state's response versus the city's response. His past, you know, his governing style, his ongoing difficulties with the progressive wing of his party. In the fall, you know, people were sort of asking more questions, and there were things about the previous 6 months that were being reexamined, and suddenly it wasn't so cut and dry that here was this American COVID hero. It was more complicated than that. It was, I think, my story sort of came out in the midst of that, so that building into something like a chorus. And then, you know, the months have passed, there was an election, and, And then these latest allegations have come out at the same time as sort of even more scrutiny on some of the nursing home stuff, which we will discuss.
Yeah. And I guess I'm wondering, like, how aware do you think Cuomo was? How much do you think going into it, he thought, okay, here's an opportunity for me to really kind of, you know, just be the guy here?
Well, I think, you know, pretty quickly he picked up on the feedback.
Yeah.
And I think he heard a lot, probably too much, about what a great job he was doing. And it became, you know, part of his own sense of how to approach this was to keep doing the thing that seemed to be working in the public relations sense. But I think also the way he responded was sort of it's the way he would have responded anyway. I can't remember who told me this, but he has sort of a rescue complex. He likes to rescue people. And there are these great old stories of him pulling over on the side of the highway, you know, in his governor's caravan when they come across an accident and rescuing, so pulling someone out of a car. And, you know, he used to drive a tow truck on weekends and nights when he was at Albany Law School. You know, whenever there's a natural disaster, I don't know if you remember, you know, Hurricane Sandy, he was there. You know, he's there in the windbreaker. You know, the governor windbreaker. It's like, so this was sort of a perfect opportunity for him to be that guy,
kind of sleeves rolled up, like performing action.
Yeah, I mean, he is an operations guy, and he also is very good at performing as operations guy. And as in most of politics, the doing and the looking like you're doing, those things bleed into each other. It's a good question as to how conscious he is of what those lines are. My impression is that he is fairly persuaded himself that he is the best suited man in America to take this kind of thing on. I think he's definitely believes what he's projecting.
Something I've talked to people about, state lawmakers and other people involved in state government in New York, is just how powerful Cuomo was before the pandemic hit. I mean, New York governors, just by virtue of the state constitution, the way it's set up, are relatively more powerful than in other states, the way that they control the budget and sort of other ways that the state works. But Cuomo's power, you know, has been described to me as kind of like, you know, it's like every governor in the past, you know, 50 years has leveraged a little bit more power for themselves. And then Cuomo was the recipient of like this long arc of like the governor of New York becoming more and more powerful. And then he's sort of, for now a decade, been kind of the unquestioned person in charge of state government. You know, you talk to people in the state government and it's like he just looms over everything. But I'm wondering if we might talk a little bit about how he got into position to be the unquestioned guy in New York politics.
Well, generally speaking, he's a great student of power. A lot of politicians are this way, obviously, but I think he's a more distilled version of this. He sees the world and he sees the world of politics in raw terms of power and who has it and how to execute it and how to neutralize it in others. I think, again, generally speaking, he's used, you know, a combination of, you know, fear and, you know, threatening people, and I don't necessarily mean that in any legal way, but just, you know, using the tools at the disposal of an executive and someone who understands how politics work and how public relations work to neutralize opponents or to, you know, to get leverage over people at the same time that he was popular with the real estate industry, which is, if not the most powerful lobbying force in the state, then one of them. He was aligned with the Greater Hospitals Association, state of New York, which has an alliance with the Hospital Workers Union. That is the other contender for the most powerful lobbying force. This happened at a time when there was a pretty weak mayor in the city of New York, Bill de Blasio, who has, I think, struggled to play the game of power, to execute within the arena of government, and especially the arena of state government versus city government, which is an age-old dynamic.
It's particularly weird in New York, where you have, like, you know, the one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest city in the world. with half the state's population, you know, having to balance its interests against like the rest of the state, you know, and it's like a sort of like basically at this point, just an ancient problem in sort of how a mayor is supposed to navigate New York's place within the state.
Right. I think, you know, even though Cuomo is from here, he is the governor of the state and is using the state power often to diminish New York in the interest of getting more power for himself.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Let's turn to the sort of news of the last few weeks, which is sort of Cuomo's whole standing and sort of grip on the state has been imperiled. And I'll give you sort of my read of how this happened, and tell me what your read is. But so basically, even going back to the spring, there were questions raised about whether the state was properly releasing data on how many nursing home residents were dying of COVID. And in January, the Attorney General of the state, Letitia James, issues a report that basically says, yeah, these numbers that have been made public aren't the full numbers. You know, it's this thing that had long been sort of assumed by a lot of critics of Cuomo. Yeah, it's true. That sort of prompts a kind of louder chorus of calls of like, hey, this is a cover-up. You know, this was bad. This is really bad. The administration, Cuomo's administration, tries to sort of limit the damage by kind of making overtures to state lawmakers in a meeting that then was leaked to the press that then just causes this whole sort of hubbub. And then sort of the real sort of key moment is when this Queens assemblyman named Ron Kim, who had been a critic of Cuomo's nursing home policies going back to the spring, he gets a call from the governor after giving some quotes to the New York Post. And the governor, according to Kim, it just balls him out. He's basically like, if you don't get in line, like, I'm going to destroy you. And Kim, instead of getting in line, he goes to the press and says, the governor is like threatening me over this nursing home deaths data that, you know, he's the one responsible for these numbers not being public. And then sort of in the aftermath of Kim going public, a bunch of other people start coming forward with stories about Cuomo and intimidation and retaliation. And that includes a number of women who come forward and say that the governor had sexually harassed them. Calls for Cuomo to resign start mounting. The attorney general announces that she's going to form an investigation into the sexual harassment claims. And basically, like, you know, this has been the last couple of weeks, just Cuomo trying to fend off these calls for him to resign, sort of apologizing to some of the women who've come forward with their sexual harassment claims, you know. And then now what we've got in Albany is many state lawmakers, including the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the Assembly, who've essentially called for Cuomo to resign, Cuomo insisting he's not going to resign, the Attorney General investigating it. Like, we've just got a standoff that nobody knows how it's going to end.
I'm hoping you're not going to ask me for prediction, because I think...
No, yeah. I think you know, prediction is impossible. It's just an unprecedented situation. I mean, Cuomo seems intent on gritting it out, unless the legislature sort of moves to impeach him. It's sort of up to him what happens next,
which is possible. Yes, I mean it's totally possible for them to impeach him.
Yeah, they're able to do it if they want to. Although, you know, I think it's notable that the Senate Majority Leader, who issued a call for him to resign, isn't saying, and if he doesn't resign, we'll move to impeach. You know, she's she's called for him to take the step.
The nursing home thing is it's both political in origin, but it's because Cuomo made this entire thing a political narrative.
Yeah.
He chose to do victory laps and to present himself as the hero of the pandemic. He wrote a book, and so the extent to which his record is under scrutiny, he brought that on himself.
Yeah.
In a way. So yeah, these are his opponents who are really in some ways driving the nursing home scandal, and we can debate the policy and how much blame the Cuomo administration bears for the high number of nursing home deaths. But it's in this case it's the cover up more than the crime. It's the monkeying around with the numbers in order to look better so that he could continue to maintain this image as hero of the pandemic.
Yeah, and I don't think it's an accident that this all started happening as sort of New York starts coming out of the pandemic, because it's also just about the balance of power. It's like you just have all these lawmakers who, like, they earnestly think that this was wrong, and they're mad about it, but it's also like Cuomo had these emergency powers and was just like even more than in the past, was just completely in charge of the state. And it was just this sense, I think, in Albany that like this couldn't hold, that there had to be kind of rebalancing, that there would have to be some kind of conflict in order to have that rebalancing happen. And this is the stuff around which that conflict is now happening.
Right. And also I think that there was the dynamic of the national election, and that there was sort of a tacit agreement's too strong a word, but understanding that we, among Democrats, maybe not to attack him too sharply and too head on, because there was a national election to be won that felt, that was considered to be sort of more consequential than any that had come along in generations. So as soon as the sort of boogeyman of Trump was removed, suddenly the sort of grimmer alternative to Cuomo was no longer there. And suddenly, the lights sort of turned on him, and the Democrats turned on him a little bit.
I thought we might talk about just how these latest stories about Cuomo, how they were and weren't present in sort of what we knew about Cuomo. A lot of the coverage talks about this, right? This kind of reputation that he'd had for as a sort of ruthless, kind of fearsome guy. And you just talked about, his sort of knowledge of kind of how to get people to do what he wanted and how to keep people in line. And sort of, I guess, how much of a surprise it is, that like he would have people come forward and say, like, he's retaliated against me, and like women come forward and say he behaved inappropriately with me. Like, just how much of this is just like totally shockingly out of nowhere.
Right. I think that the reputation he has, especially among those who have been around him and been around, Albany, is of him as, a very difficult boss. It's a difficult place to work. He's relentless. He's hectoring. He's demanding. He gets angry, and in all of my reporting on the profile and just following him for years, I hadn't heard specifically about sexual harassment. I don't know that was something that was understood to be a thing that was being covered up. I have a sense that as a boss, he harasses people. He's in your face. He expects you there 24/7. He talks about your private life. He expects your private life to, there is no private life. It's, it's sort of render unto Cuomo your entire existence and to this job 24/7. That would also leach into sexual harassment. It doesn't surprise me. The hectoring, the banter, the flirtation. I've heard stories of him in his dealings with women sort of socially, not professionally, not in his office. So it doesn't have a workplace component, but he's flirtatious. He can turn on the charm. He can be intense. I know someone who talked of him grabbing her arm in a way that was just too much, that kind of thing. So it's not shocking. It's surprising that he would get himself in this mess. That's, I think, the biggest surprise for me.
what the administration, like, you know, they've put out statements in the last few weeks where, you know, his aides have said things like, it's a demanding job here, you know, he demands everything from you. And it's tough to work here because that's the business of government, you know. And I mean, they're basically admitting that the way that the administration is described by people who are like, this is a horrible place, it's like basically true. It's like, it's just like the critics, their takeaway is that that's bad. Our takeaway is like, this is what's necessary to get things done, which kind of like fits into like the whole Cuomo thing of like getting things done. But does a governor's office really need to run that way?
No, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of some of the modern debates over coaching. You know, the old football coach would abuse the players, you know, no water, 8-hour August practice, you know, nearly kill the people. And it's not like that anymore. In some ways, Andrew Cuomo's an old kind of boss, but he's like an extreme version of an old kind of boss in an era where that's just not going to fly.
His defense of that has been like the same, what you're saying, like the kind of like, oh, well, I'm old school. Like, you know, I send all the women in my office roses on Valentine's Day. Like, that's an old school move. And it's like, that how does one not see that that is just not a thing that you should do anymore? And just watching Cuomo these last few weeks, you know, like he's spent so much time on air, you know, since last March. And I'm wondering, just watching Cuomo these last few weeks, like if anything has struck you in the way that he's been talking about these scandals, you know, and this situation that he's in. Every time he does a press conference now, he tries to go back into sort of March 2020 Cuomo mode. Here are the numbers. And then the questions come and they're all like about like, what do you say to these women? It's because it's March 2021. But I'm wondering sort of like what you make of the way he personally has responded to this whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he's trying to just do his job in part to distract from the fact that this other thing is endangering his job. He's good at it. I mean, he's still an effective communicator. Obviously, it seems most people find his apologies wanting. But nonetheless, you know, he's not fumbling. He's parsing everything in a way that is legalistic and self-serving. You know, he keeps saying, I'm a lawyer. It's like, well, we can tell. you know, that's the public face that we see. I imagine him, you know, when he's off camera, you know, I imagine him sort of glowering, you know, engaged and scheming.
Yeah.
You know, dark clouds gathering around him, you know, lightning, bats, you know, cars blowing up in the street, like Carrie or something. I can't, it's hard for me to imagine what he's going through as he sort of tries to think and fight his way out of this mess. It's just deepening with every few days.
Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Nick Paumgarten is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.